This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are brothers Joel and Ethan Coen, who wrote and directed such films as Blood Simple, Fargo, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, A Serious Man, and True Grit. Their 2016 film, Hail Caesar, was a comic homage to Hollywood in the late 40s and 50s, including the biblical epics and musicals the studios produced. Their new movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, is an homage to Westerns. The film is an anthology of six stories, sometimes comic, involving staples of the Western genre: a singing cowboy, gunfights, a wagon train, stagecoaches, hangings, a grizzled prospector panning for gold. But what happens within each story is typically not what you'd expect from a classic Western. Reviewing the film in the New York Times, A.O. Scott wrote, "The brothers have tended to treat whimsy and fatalism as sides of the same coin. The jokes that the universe plays on hapless human creatures may be cruel, but they're also funny, and the Coens are skilled and wily metaphysical pranksters." Let's start with the opening voiceover from the first story in the film, in which singing cowboy Buster Scruggs is riding through the desert on his horse. His hands are not on the reins, they're wrapped around his guitar because he's a singing cowboy. Buster Scruggs, played by Tim Blake Nelson, sings and introduces himself to us.
"Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me?"
Whoa! A song never fails to ease my mind out here in the West, where the distances are great and the scenery monotonous. Additionally, my pleasing baritone seems to inspirit old Dan here and keep him in good heart during the day's measure of hoof clops. Ain't that right, Dan? Maybe some of y'all have heard of me. Buster Scruggs, known to some as the San Saba Songbird. I got other handles, nicknames, appellations, and cognomens, but this one here I don't consider to be even halfway earned. Misanthrope, I don't hate my fellow man, even when he's tiresome and surly and tries to cheat at poker. I figure that's just the human material, and him that finds in it cause for anger and dismay is just a fool for expecting better. Ain't that right, Dan?"
Joel and Ethan Coen, welcome to Fresh Air. Thanks for coming back on our show. So how did this movie come together? Like, how did you end up stringing together several different stories of the Old West in one film?
Well, we started writing them. Well, they weren't even them when we started. We wrote the first of what turned out to be this collection at least 20 years ago. It's actually the first one in the movie, the Tim Blake Nelson singing cowboy one. We just wrote it kind of on a lark, not really thinking about what we'd do with it or that we would do anything with it, because, you know, there's not much of a market for short movies, and it was a short standalone story. But then we found ourselves, we wrote a couple more over the years, and at a certain point we thought there's almost enough that they kind of make sense together, and maybe we'll write a couple more and make a feature, you know, an anthology feature out of it.
But, you know, the genesis of it was pretty pure in the sense that we were writing them without any real expectation or intention of making them. And, yeah, at a certain point we said, well, there's these, you know, four or five stories in the drawer, and they all happen to be Westerns. And what if we did make them all together? And what would that be?
It's interesting you said our motives were pure because we weren't thinking about making them.
Yes, it's true. But they weren't dirtied by the marketplace.
Vincent Gallo self-financed, I think, his last movie, and he decided not to release it because he didn't want to. And I think this is a verbatim quote. He didn't want to expose it to the dark energies of the public.
Westerns usually end with the surviving good guys vanquishing the bad guys and restoring order to the town. But your stories don't end that way in this Western anthology. Death can come suddenly no matter who you are. Did you ever ask yourself while you were writing and directing it if you think you might have survived living in the Old West? Like, how long you think you would have lasted?
We just barely survived living in the Midwest.
That's funny. Each story is told as if it were a short story from a collection of Western stories. In one of the stories, it's set in a stagecoach, and it's like a series of monologues within the stagecoach in which each character tells us something about who they are and what they believe. And one of the characters, played by Brendan Gleeson, without giving much away about who they really are, one of the characters played by Brendan Gleeson sings a version of The Streets of Laredo that I've never heard before. The lyric I'm familiar with is a song set in the Old West where the guy singing the song sees a young cowboy in the streets of Laredo who's wrapped up in white linen as cold as the clay. And the young cowboy explains that he's done wrong. He's been shot in the chest and he knows he's dying. And he instructs the other man how he wants to be buried and what to tell his mother. Gleason sings a different version of it. This version is sung by a man killed by his lover. So I just want to play some of that song. So this is Brendan Gleeson.
As I was a-walking down by the lock, as I was a-walking one morning of late, who should I spy but my own dear comrade, wrapped up in flannel, so hard is his fate. I boldly stepped up to and kindly did ask him, why are you wrapped in flannel so white? My body is injured and sadly disordered, all by a young woman, my own heart's delight. Oh, had she but told me when she disordered me, and she but told me of it at the time, I might have got salts or pills of white mercury. But now I'm cut down in the height of my prime.
I think that's pretty beautiful. Did you know he could sing?
No. We sent him the song probably a month or two before we started shooting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And said, you know, take a crack at this, and Brendan sent it back, and we thought, oh, beautiful. We knew that we wanted the song sung in the sequence, but whether or not it was actually going to be Brendan who did it, or, you know, or we were going to replace it somehow if he wasn't a sing, you know, couldn't sing it. We didn't know, but it turned out, no, he sang it quite beautifully. That's the original, well, I don't know about the original. These are, you know, these are like folk songs. They're, that ballad goes way back. That's an early version of that song about a man who is, well, it's about a man whose lover gives him a venereal disease, and he dies of it.
The use of the word disordered is so interesting in it. Like, what does he say? She disordered my body?
Had she but told me before she disordered me.
Yeah, that's...
I might have got pills, salts or pills of white mercury.
Right. I didn't realize it was about syphilis or some
mm-hmm.
STD.
Yeah,
oh,
it's
yeah.
About syphilis.
I was trying to figure out what the white mercury pills were about. Like, those mm-hmm. are not pills we take anymore.
Right. Other ways of treating syphilis.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and you bookend the whole movie with an instrumental version of The Streets of Laredo. So it is one of, like, the classic death songs about mm-hmm. the Old West. Is that why you chose it? Because there is
yeah.
so much death in the movie.
Yeah, it's a, you know, beautiful elegiac song about death, and it's familiar to almost everyone, at least the melody is. But it was interesting to us to... you know, have it make its appearance in the movie, at least when you hear the song, with lyrics that people weren't familiar with and that probably were more appropriate to the period.
Okay, stupid question. Did you ever hear the Alan Sherman parody version of Streets of Laredo?
Of course.
Called Streets yeah. of Miami. That's really horrible.
We're really big on Alan Sherman.
No, yes, he was... absolute giant in our youth.
Do you remember the lyrics?
Vaguely.
I don't remember the Streets of Miami very. No, not really.
He stays at the Fountain Blue. He's because the Fountain Blue Hotel. He's taking a trip with his instead of his like a sidekick or something. It says like partner Sammy. It has the line and paid to the firm $60 a day. No. I mean, charged to the firm $60 a day because he's expensing the trip. So another story I want to talk about from your film takes place on a wagon train. And that's another trope of Westerns. Why did you want to do a wagon train story?
I think it really was our sort of, at a certain point, rummaging around in the Western genre, thinking, well, we haven't, you know, and thinking about the sort of subgenres. Well, we haven't done a wagon train movie, or we haven't done a stagecoach movie. That might be interesting. So we came up with that. I have to say that it might have been a good idea on paper, but when we discovered when we went out to shoot this wagon train movie, and most of it was shot over about a month in Western Nebraska, we realized it was just an incredible pain.
Well, sure, because you have like nearly, it looks like a mile of wagons with people walking alongside of them, and there's horses and oxen. It's like a lot.
Yeah, and the problem is that you have, you know, essentially sort of a half a mile long chain of wagons, and the camera's in a certain position, and when you say action, the first wagon moves, and 10 minutes later, the last wagon can start moving, and you finally got everything going together, and then one oxen team will decide to cut sharply over to the right and ruin the shot. So you then have a choice, which is to reposition all the wagons back where they were in relationship to the camera position, which will take an hour or so, or move the camera back and reposition the wagons, but in a not as beautiful camera position for the shot. And this was, you know, over and over and over.
Well, I remember after we talked about your movie Inside Llewyn Davis, where there was a cat who was a co-star of the film, you said you would never work with a cat again. And so now you've put yourself in the position with this film of working with, like, oxen and horses, a dog, there's an
owl.
Yeah,
but no cats.
But it seems to me like you set yourself up for trouble.
Yes, we did.
Had you forgotten how hard it was just to work with a cat?
The problem is when you're writing it, it's so easy to write. So you just go, okay, you know, wagon train.
Yeah, there are 20 wagons. It's easy to write.
How many wranglers did you have working on this?
Many. I don't even, you know, it varied. In the Nebraska thing, there were wranglers for every team and every few horses. But they're great, but the animals are, sadly, they're just animals. They, you know, sometimes they play ball and sometimes they don't.
What did the oxen wrangler say to you at one point?
Oh, Travis, the oxen wrangler, great guy. So I asked him if the oxen could, I don't know what it was, come to a mark and stop or something. And it was something that seemed kind of simple to me. And he rolled his eyes with a kind of silent idiot look. And he said, you know, driving oxen is not as self-evident as people think it is. And I thought, man, that's, yeah. Why should that be different than anything else on a movie?
Are oxen responsive? I mean, I've never worked with an ox.
Not exactly. There's a considerable, or, you know,
there's
a specific lag time. Yeah. There's between when you, you know, use the little prod or give it a little flick. Yeah. On its rump with you know, whatever they drive them with, and when the oxen actually decides to attend to your wishes.
They got a hell of a neural network there. It takes a while to travel.
So this was shot in video instead of film, is that right?
Video? Well, digitally.
Digitally, yeah. I should say. Yeah.
Video, not we didn't go quite that far.
Right. Were you used to shooting digitally?
No, this is the first thing we've shot not on film, first time for us.
And is this because it's streaming on Netflix?
No, how it actually ends up getting put out, although it's also coming out theatrically in a few cities. No, it was, I don't know what it was. It was partly convenience, partly a matter of, you know, we knew we wanted to do a lot of early morning, late afternoon, evening kind of, you know, magic hour shooting, and you get a little more in terms of the stop. You get a little more latitude in terms of how much light you need shooting digitally as opposed to film.
It was an experiment, really. We hadn't done it before, and, you know, it's becoming overwhelmingly the norm, and this seemed like a reasonable movie to give it a try. I think that at the end of the day, we're very happy with the way the movie looks. The sort of getting there isn't as much fun, but the end result is in certain ways more convenient, and it's certainly just as good.
Does it change how you watch rushes?
Very much so.
What's the difference?
You know, if you're shooting on film, there's something that happens between when you're actually recording the information on the set and when you see it for the first time. It goes to a lab. It's, you know, it's emulsion, light exposing an emulsion that gets developed, goes to a lab, gets printed, comes back usually the next day or a couple of days later. And in between that, when you finally see it, it reveals something. And that what it reveals is interesting, and it's sort of unfolding as you go through the process. None of that happens digitally. You look at a monitor and you see pretty much exactly what you're, you know, going to get. In fact, watching dailies almost becomes superfluous. So watching dailies in the old days, if you're shooting on film, used to be a sort of communal thing where at the end of the day or sometimes during lunch, everyone would get together, you would go into a theater, and you would watch the results of the previous day's work with the whole crew, or much of the crew. Shooting digitally, you almost stop watching dailies entirely. I mean, we almost stop watching them. We've seen them on the monitor as they were being shot.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Shooting on film, you're actually making decisions and committing to how it's going to look to a large degree. And shooting digitally, it's more like you're capturing information and you're deferring all those decisions and you're going to decide later how it's going to look. So that's kind of,
yes.
As Joel was saying, that's kind of, it makes watching dailies pointless because you haven't decided anything. Nobody actually took a picture. They just captured some information that they're going to turn into a picture later.
Is this because, like, why are you calling it just information when you're shooting digitally?
But because what you're doing is you're...
Yeah.
Because, there's so much latitude in what you're capturing. You can make it look like pretty much anything later in terms of contrast, in terms of color, in terms of pretty much everything. Half of what you think you're doing when you're composing a picture, you're sort of deferring decisions about how it's going to look until later. Because when you capture it on film, it's actually in the grain of the negative. And when you're capturing it digitally, you're just sort of recording pixels, all of which are negotiable later.
I've always wondered, though, how directors feel confident that they have a good shot and a good take when they actually haven't seen the film itself.
Well, you know, that also gets into why DPs are so fond of digital photography. Most of them will say, if you ask them the difference, they'll say they can sleep at night because they actually know what they're getting on the set.
Mm-hmm.
But from my point of view, that's not necessarily a good thing.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking with us. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for coming back to our show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for us, too.
Joel and Ethan Coen wrote and directed the new film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It's showing in theaters and is also streaming on Netflix. For several days in January 2015, national media crews and a growing crowd of people in Yosemite National Park were craning their necks upward, anxiously watching two men hundreds of feet above on a vertical cliff of the famous El Capitan rock formation. Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen were attempting a 3,000-foot free climb up a sheer wall that was previously thought impossible to ascend. The ascent took 19 days, and their remarkable feat was captured by a crew of documentary filmmakers, themselves rock climbers. The new documentary, The Dawn Wall, is now available for streaming on iTunes and will be available on demand December 4th. As you'll hear, Tommy Caldwell became an accomplished rock climber early in his life, but had to overcome some shocking and traumatic experiences before taking on his historic climb, including losing the tip of his index finger in a table saw accident that many people thought would end his career. Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Tommy Caldwell, Kevin Jorgensen, welcome to Fresh Air. When most people think of rock climbing, they're probably thinking of something different from what you do, free climbing. You want to explain the difference?
What we do is we free climb on extremely large rocks. So specifically, El Capitan, the biggest rock face in North America. We spend multiple days up there and we sleep in portal ledges. And yeah, it's just rock climbing on a much grander scale.
Right. And Kevin, I mean, people who go to a gym and come up with ropes, you guys don't use ropes or other tools to help yourselves advance up a face, right?
Yeah, the key distinction to keep in mind is that our ropes are only there to catch us if we fall. It's not like we're facing death with every move that we make. That's not our discipline. Our discipline is pushing the difficulty barriers, boundaries, pushing the difficulty boundaries of the sport. And that means you're falling all the time. You're falling and failing way more often than you're succeeding. So you can imagine the ropes are a pretty important part of the process.
Right. But the ropes are slack when you're climbing, right? Every advance must be made with your own hands and feet, and that's all, right?
Yep. That's exactly right.
Right. It seems, from watching this, there are times when you're supporting much of the weight of your body on the fingers of one hand, maybe just two fingers, right? How do you do that?
Yeah. I mean, climbing on El Capitan is extremely technical. You have to imagine that it's, you know, as sheer and as vertical as the side of a skyscraper. But what's cool about vertical climbing is that it's very balance oriented. So if you have a nub big enough to stand on for your feet, it often doesn't take a whole lot to grip onto for your hands in order to make it all work. It's this really delicate dance at times. Other times it's really powerful and physical, but sometimes it's just really precarious balancing act moves.
You say you stand on a nub.
I called it a nub, yeah.
What is that?
Oh, like picture a thimble or just like your thumb sticking out from the wall, just a little tiny surface area.
Right. So it's a matter of sort of how you distribute your weight and find leverage just the right places at the right times.
I think a good analogy is choreography. Uh-huh. So you can compare it to choreographing a gymnastics routine or a dance. It's highly precise, and that's part of how Tommy and I spent those 6-7 years preparing, was figuring out how to unlock the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And that consists of the choreography of the moves themselves across the rock.
When you're climbing, you have to advance with your hands and feet, but you are tethered to a rope. How is the rope secured to the rock face so that it can catch you if you fall?
Right. So you have a 200-foot rope is what we use. And as the first person climbs, they put in protection into cracks. If there's no cracks, occasionally there's little holes drilled that have these bolts in them. And so every, 8 to 20 feet, you clip into one of these protection points. And so if you can envision that, if you're climbing above a protection point, say you're 10 feet above it, and you fall, you're going to fall 20 feet plus rope stretch, if that makes sense. And then your belayer is holding the other end of the rope. That's your climbing partner. So the first person goes up putting in these pieces of protection. They stop, they belay, and the second person follows them up. And then you repeat that process over and over again until you get to the top.
What are the dangers? When can things go wrong?
I mean, there's so many possible dangers. On the Don Wall specifically, I think our main danger was icefall. We needed to climb in the middle of the winter for the conditions for the friction on our skin. It needed to be quite cold, so we climbed in the middle of the winter, which meant every morning when the sun would hit the wall, the water that had frozen onto the wall the night before would shed off the wall and ice chunks would come flying down the wall. So you have to figure out ways to deal with that kind of stuff. Complacency was a big one. Since we were up there for 19 days, you know, just overlooking being tied in properly or, if you're a new climber, in some ways you're safer because you're aware of everything. You don't get complacent. But when you've been doing it so long, like we have, that becomes one of the dangers, is you just get too comfortable in that environment.
Yeah. Right. And you mentioned a portalage. This is kind of like a portable tent that hangs from the side of the mountain that you sleep in?
Yeah, it's our little nest up on the wall. It's a hanging cot. It has a metal frame that's strung with fabric in between, and it hangs from straps into a single clip-in point, and then a tent goes all around it. So, yeah, it's your little pod. And on El Capitan specifically, you end up spending a tremendous amount of time in these portaledges. It becomes, you know, it's your home. It's where you cook. It's where you sleep. It's where you eat. It's where you go to the bathroom. Anytime you're not climbing, you're in these portaledges.
I'm interested in how you got into this. Tommy, what were you like as a kid?
I was actually this super shy, underground kid who was kind of mentally delayed. I had a father who was very masculine. He was a mountain climber himself, a mountain guide, and a school teacher. And so getting into it was, you know, that's just kind of what we did as a family. But I got into it maybe a little bit more intensely because my dad was looking for, you know, something that would build confidence in his son and kind of toughen him up a little bit. So we'd go on pretty extreme adventures when I was like 4 or 5 years old. I've learned how to be, you know, thousands of feet off the ground by the time I was 6 years old, which is not a normal way to be raised.
In the film, you describe your dad, who was also a bodybuilder, right? Competitive bodybuilder. You said in the film he was loving, but he definitely made you suffer. In what way?
Yeah, elective suffering, yeah. I mean, he was super loving. He is super loving. He's like my biggest fan. I mean, there were times where I think he even took it too far, and he recognizes that in retrospect. Like, you know, we would do these ski tours when I was 4 and 5 years old, and I remember one particular ski tour where I fell down this hill and fell into this hole in the ice, basically, and was suspended upside down by my skis with the ball of my hat bobbing in the water. And luckily my skis were strong enough to support me, but if it would have gone a little bit differently, I would have gone under the ice. You know, things like that where like, ooh, man, it's a good thing I made it through my childhood. It was a little touch and go at times.
Yeah. Kevin Jorgensen, how did you get into this? What kind of kid were you?
My earliest memories are of waking up on the, you know, side of a river. You know, my dad was a rafting guide, and my childhood was spent rafting and hiking and hunting and just always in the outdoors. Climbing was something that has been innate for as long as I can remember. My parents tell stories of me climbing trees and cupboards and fences and ladders and things like that before I even have memory of them. So I think it was something that's always been supernatural for me, but I didn't find the sport until I was 11 when I went to the grand opening of a local climbing gym.
There's a remarkable part of the story that takes place in Central Asia involving Tommy. Tommy, you and some fellow climbers went to the Central Asian country of Kyrgyzstan. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so this was my first big international climbing expedition. I was sort of an aspiring professional climber. I was living on about $50 a month, and I was dating a girl who got invited on this trip, and I managed to kind of weasel my way on as a rope rigger. And it was a big opportunity for me. I was all of a sudden with some really good climbers going to one of the most beautiful mountain regions in the world, in Kyrgyzstan. And so we organized this trip. We flew into this really remote mountain valley in Kyrgyzstan, and were dropped off by a helicopter. We're about 30 miles from the nearest road. And while we were there, a rebel group called the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan came through this region. The political situation is kind of complicated, but it, you know, in some ways boils down to opium trade for funding the Taliban. and we were in this mountain valley. So they saw us up on the wall. They saw, you know, a big base camp with a bunch of equipment. I think they had dollar signs in their eyes. They took us hostage, and not too long after that, the Kyrgyzstan military, the Kyrgyz military, showed up, and this war broke out all around us. We had to abandon all of our food and clothing, along with our captors, and basically hide under gunpoint for 6 days from the Kyrgyzstan military.
Wow. And this began with when you were up on a rock face, and suddenly there's random gunfire coming up at you. These were the rebels signaling to you that you were to come down and submit, right?
Yeah, our moment of getting taken hostage was when we were sleeping in our portaledges about 1,000 feet up a wall, and the rebels showed up at the base of the wall, and they had these kind of long-range sniper rifles, and they shot up at us. And we had two portaledges up there. They're about 4 feet apart, and they managed to get these bullets right between the two portaledges. yeah, it was pretty terrifying.
Right. So they're marching you around after they have a skirmish with the Kyrgyzstan army, and well, you end up being marched for 6 days with essentially no food by one of these guys, and there's a desperate plan that you guys figure is your only way out of this. You want to explain what happened?
Yeah, I mean, the whole time we were looking for ways to escape, and our captors were becoming progressively weaker, as were we, but we were actually holding up a little bit better because we were mountain climbers, and our captors had actually hiked over this big mountain pass before they even got to us in the first place. So we started out in a little bit better shape. And at some point, we realized, or actually the other members of our expedition came up with the idea that our plan to escape would be to overtake our captors. And I wasn't on board with this. We had watched them kill people in front of us point blank, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. But on our sixth night of captivity, we're climbing up this really steep mountainside. We were left with just one remaining captor because the lead member of the rebel group had gone back to our base camp to try and find some food. And it just became painfully obvious. A storm was rolling in. It seemed like it was going to rain. We were on the verge of hypothermia. I was certain that we weren't going to live if we got exposed in the storm on the side of this mountain. And so, yeah, it became obvious to me that our only chance of living through this would be to push our captor over the edge of this cliff because we were in really exposed terrain. The logistics of it were quite easy once we made the decision. And so that's where we got out of there. I pushed him off the cliff. He bounced off a ledge about 30 feet below us and then fell out of sight. And then we ran for about 6 miles to the nearest Kyrgyz military outpost.
Right. And as it happened, you just happened to be the one of you who was in position to actually do this, to grab the guy's gun strap and push him over the side. Do you remember that moment, what it felt like?
Yeah, I remember it quite vividly. You know, I don't think you forget that kind of stuff, really. I mean, it was this overwhelming outflow of emotion. I was really concerned about what, you know, I was dating Beth Rodden at the time, who was another member of the expedition, and she was really against us taking matters into our own hands. So just before going and doing this, I kind of went up to her, and I was like, I think, you know, the other members of our expedition who have been talking about this, they don't really want to do it. Do you think I should do this? Do you agree this is our only way to live? And she didn't say anything. And so that was sort of that told me that she was going to be okay with it. So once the decision was made, I scrambled across this ledge as he was climbing this really steep section. I grabbed the gun strap and pulled him off. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to articulate. I mean, I think it was so intense of a moment that I remember it as almost like a dreamscape. I remember the stars. I remember the moon. I kind of remember the colors around us, the colors in the nighttime kind of swirling in my vision, and then me sitting on the ground and just putting my hands on my head and kind of rocking back and forth and being like, what did I just do? I can't believe I just did that.
Right. Well, people who are in the military are trained for this, and it's very, very hard. You had to confront whether you could kill somebody. And as it turned out, you didn't, right? But you didn't know that.
Yeah, we didn't know this for several months, but a reporter who was researching the story actually found out that the guy that I had pushed was in prison in Kyrgyzstan. You know, he'd fallen down the mountain. He had miraculously stopped on a ledge, that was down there, you know, out of sight from where we were, and he lived through it.
Well, and of course, you were with Beth Rodden then, who was your girlfriend and climbing partner, right? I mean, and you stayed together, you got married, and you shared this trauma. I mean, you guys had both seen your captor shoot somebody in the head, and then this thing. Do you think, I don't know, what was it like for the two of you to have, you know, enter into this relationship having shared that kind of experience?
I mean, it was pretty intense. When we started dating, a couple months before this expedition to Kyrgyzstan, so the whole romance was fresh. After that experience, we couldn't part. We couldn't be away from each other. The psychological effects of what happened to us affected us all quite differently, and I was really traumatized for about a year. But after that year, I think that I found the whole experience quite empowering, and that might actually be because I was the one who actually did the pushing. Like, at some point, I was like, man, I had this strength inside of me. I found the strength, and I went from being kind of worried about that to being proud of that. And so I became kind of a strong figure. Beth, on the other hand, just, you know, she just had a hard time. There was probably about 6 years where anytime I would leave her side, she would get pretty scared. And so I just didn't leave her side. And we got married, and it was, you know, it seemed wonderful in a lot of ways. Like, we had this bond that really you don't find in everyday life, because we had been through something that was so intense together. Yeah.
And the marriage in the end didn't last.
Yeah, the marriage in the end didn't last. I think we realized that it just didn't start out in the best way. It was, you know, there was a lot of codependency issues. And at some point, she started to resent the fact that she felt like she needed me there all the time.
So let's talk about this climb up El Capitan. El Capitan in Yosemite National Park is this amazing rock formation that a lot of people have seen. It's been climbed by many people, but there's this one rock face, the Dawn Wall, which had not been climbed. Explain why it's called that and why it seemed almost impossible to climb up to that point.
Yeah, so you're right. El Capitan itself had been climbed a lot. You know, historically, it was climbed by aid, where you sort of attach these ladders to the wall and you climb the ladders. Free climbers got a hold of it in the early 70s, and so we started climbing it, you know, with just our hands and feet, and the ropes were there to catch us. And there was about 12 routes on El Cap that had been free climbed, but they followed these distinct crack systems. To the right of center, though, was this big, vast, blank-looking face. And to me, that was the next level. It looked impossible. It looked like there was nothing to grab onto. But I had climbed so much on El Cap at that point that I was the one person that knew on these faces that look blank from afar, these little tiny razor blade edges sometimes form. And if you train yourself properly, you can learn to support your body weight. And then if you practice it enough, you can learn to move from one edge to the next. And the idea of linking all of these little tiny holds for 3,000 feet was the fascination behind it.
So you spent years surveying this and trying different parts of it, right? You're essentially kind of, what, developing a map of these razor-like holds?
Yeah, exactly. I gathered a bunch of rope, and I walked to the top of the wall, and then I would rappel down, hanging from the rope, and swing back and forth, and analyze the surface of the rock, run my fingers over it, feel all the holds, try and unlock this incredibly complicated, vast puzzle. So that took about a year, and then that's when Kevin joined the project.
Okay. So you climbed in January because you said the friction is better between your shoes and the rocks.
Yeah, and being cold was absolutely crucial because, yeah, the friction's better. But what that means is, you know, like the rubber on your shoes is harder, so it doesn't sort of tear when you stand on these little tiny footholds. The skin on your fingertips is a bit harder, so your skin doesn't tear as easily. And it took us a lot of years to figure out that being really cold was absolutely necessary. So that's why we'd climb at night.
Right. So you could climb on a cloudy day but not a sunny day because you needed the lower temperature?
Exactly. So the overcast day is kind of the same as climbing in the shade.
Yeah, it's funny. That side of El Cap is this giant solar collector. So when all the crowds of people started to gather at the base, they were standing in Yosemite Valley, and it was like, you know, 25 degrees, and they're all shivering in down jackets. And we're up there on the wall, and it's, you know, nobody really knows that it would be like 80 degrees in the sun, and we'd be up there without our shirts on, and everybody would just be looking up being like, those guys are so hardcore. They don't have their shirts on. It's so cold. Yeah.
So tell me, how did you, I mean, after trying for years, what made the difference? How did you figure out to climb across the porcelain?
I mean, we had worked out so many details. I trained extra hard for the previous 6 months leading up to it. I decided for the first time in my life to try and drop weight. So I had lost like 10 pounds in weight. And so, you know, I was super lean, super strong. The moves were wired completely, you know, perfectly into my mind. And then interesting, one of the big breakthroughs was on previous years, we had been climbing every day for months on end, and the skin on our fingertips would get really, really rock solid, like the calluses would get really thick. And on this year, we decided to take a 2-week break and let those calluses shed off our fingertips. And so on these really tiny razor blade holds, having softer skin actually was better because the skin could mold behind the holds a little bit. And so my skin consistency, you know, it sounds so weird to talk about skin consistency, but, you know, it made a really big difference. And so, you know, that was part of it. But also, there was so much leading up to it that it created flow state. Like, I was just operating at a higher level than really any other time in my life. I mean, maybe it's happened 3 or 4 times in my life where I reached this really optimal flow state, and I was in that flow state. It felt magical. I felt weightless. You know, I felt like I could fly, kind of. And that's sort of why you climb in a lot of ways. You're trying to reach the state that just wouldn't happen in normal everyday life.
Wow. So Tommy gets through pitch 15, and he starts making his way up. And we have a moment in the film here where Tommy has reached Wino Tower, and Kevin is still back, having not crossed this lateral pitch 15. So this is a moment where, Tommy, you could go ahead and make it up to the top, probably, on your own. Were you guys communicating with each other at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we were belaying each other. You know, after I did that pitch 15, every night I would go and I would climb another pitch of the route. I would get farther away from Kevin's high points. And each time I would do this, I would feel kind of progressively worse. You know, and so when I got to Wino Tower, it should have been this moment that was sort of the realization of this 7-year goal. Like, I knew success was absolutely inevitable at that point. But it didn't feel right. It felt hollow. And so I think in a lot of ways, that's the power of this story. It was like we had to decide what was more important, the personal victory or sort of the brotherhood that we had developed over all these years of climbing.
And Kevin,
yeah,
how did you finally pull it off?
Oh, man. So the pitch 15 battle, it consisted of 7 days, basically, of attempts and failures and rest. It all came together on my 7th day of attempts. I'll never forget it. It was January 9th. When I woke up, there was something different in the air. I looked outside, and it was cloudy for the first time on the entire trip, which is awesome because what that meant is that I was going to be able to climb in the daylight instead of the darkness. And there was also this nice icy updraft blowing up the wind. So when I stuck my hand out the portal edge, there was this nice cold breeze, which is great conditions for climbing. I had just taken 2 consecutive days of rest, so my skin was in the best condition that it had been in the past week. The condition of my skin was one of the primary reasons I was failing on pitch 15. My skin was all cut up and torn. Throughout most of my attempts, I was covering them in super glue and tape and just trying to push through it, but it just wasn't working. But after taking 2 days rest, I was able to climb without some tape on one of my fingers, which made a big difference. And the other thing that happened is that I decided to change my choreography at the hardest part, at the crux sequence, just to kind of, I thought I would have a better chance for success, but I also wanted to trick my body into a new routine. You know, when you try something 10, 11 times and you get the same outcome, your body almost expects to fail when you get to that point. So part of it was physical. I truly thought that it was the better way. But part of it was also mental. Yeah, on my 2nd try that day, on my 7th day of attempts, I think it was day 14 of being on the wall. It all came together, and it felt amazing, as you can imagine. I mean, it was totally cathartic. If there ever is like a bottom of the ninth or a Super Bowl moment in climbing, it kind of felt that way.
You know, people come from all over the country to see Yosemite. What's it like to see it from, you know, 2,500 feet up?
When you're up there so much, you start to notice these incredible natural phenomenons. And one of my favorite was in the warmer months when the water would come down as water, not as ice. Sometimes we get these big, like, gumdrop-sized drops of water that would sort of float down the wall. And on a big wall, it seems like they're falling in slow motion. And when the sun is on the wall, it creates this thermal updraft. So you have this falling water and then this updraft of wind that makes these gumdrop-sized water droplets float in the air, sometimes almost motionless right in front of you, and the sun shining on them, so they're sort of glimmering. And yeah, it's unbelievably beautiful.
Well, Kevin Jorgensen, Tommy Caldwell, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen are the subjects of the documentary The Dawn Wall, which is on iTunes now and will be on demand starting December 4th. They spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.